You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good evening, everybody. Thanks ever so much for coming down to the RSA this evening, where we are about to embark upon a very relaxed... You do know it's going to be very relaxed, don't you? It's going to be a very, very relaxed evening, which we'll invite panellists and then, of course, yourselves to comment on what has thus far been... Well, all these overused words like unprecedented and apocalyptic suddenly seem relevant in the context of 2016. Like most journalists, I'm chalking it up as very, very good for the job, not so good for the soul. But that, of course, is a matter of opinion, and we shall examine all complexions of opinion in the course of this evening. Just off the top of my head, with regard to the aftermath now to the American election, a cartoon I saw earlier of a father whose little girl is lying in bed with an enormous monster standing behind him, and the father is saying to his little girl, "Okay, darling, he is actually in your room, but he's here now. Why don't we just give him a chance and see how all this pans out?" The other story, which I'm not sure has reached the British media yet, and I'm also not sure whether I clumsily translated the Spanish quite correctly, but it's being reported in Argentina that Mr. Trump, President-elect Trump, used his call to their president to suggest that they might want to speed up or expedite a couple of planning issues he has with regard to some commercial interests in the area. That will concern you or not concern you, according to where you're sitting on this issue. And then, of course, you have the appointments of people who, I think, however hard one tries to be objective, it's very difficult not to conclude that they're all thus far, all the high-profile nominees and appointments, are a heck of a lot better known for the constituency of people that they have previously professed to hate than they are for any particular achievement of leadership in the context of their profession, particularly the putative new Attorney General who failed to become a judge or failed to get past the Senate to become a judge on the grounds of his history of racism. But we are in uncharted territory. We are obviously in new waters. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce you this evening to John Prideaux, who is the US editor at the Economist magazine. Melly McDonough is a leader writer at The Standard, but here, of course, this evening in a personal capacity. Stephen Bush, a special correspondent at The New Statesman and a rather waspish cookery writer in The Weekend Guardian. I don't imagine we'll be drawing on that field of expertise much this evening, but as I've said, 2016 is a year for breaking rules and defying convention, so if you have got problems with your poached eggs, Stephen is the man to go to. And finally, Malcolm Chalmers, of course, the Deputy Director General at the Royal United Services Institute, who will be holding the defence and security brief, I think, this evening. Let's begin then with inviting each of our panellists this evening to say a few words, to speak for a few minutes on where they are and where they think we are. John, I'll begin, if I may, with you.
Thanks all for coming very much. My name's John Prideaux. I'm the US editor at The Economist, which is a strange British newspaper magazine hybrid based in London, but we sell most of our copies in the US, so I write my stuff for an American audience. I lived in Washington until last year. I was there last week. Our brief was to talk for 5 minutes as by way of introduction, and I've spent pretty much all of the past year and a half writing about Trump, thinking about American politics, so that is a tough brief. And so I thought, instead of trying to give you my potted summary of Trumpism, I'd just tell a story from the Florida Republican primary earlier this year. So I was standing outside a polling station, and I talked to a voter, an elderly Cuban sort of emigre, as he came out, and asked him if he'd mind telling me how he voted. And he said that he preferred Donald Trump, but that he had voted for Ted Cruz. And I said, okay, so walk me through that. How did that come about? He said, well, this country needs a dictator, which is why I wanted Trump to win, but I didn't want to blame myself if the country did get a dictator, so I voted for Ted Cruz. Then the next voter I talked to was a lady who worked for the federal government, and I asked her how she had voted, and she explained that she had voted for Marco Rubio, senator for Florida, and a kind of noted small government conservative, and she had voted for him because she was fed up with cuts to the federal government's budget. So what I think you take from that story, what I took from it at least, is that what happens in an election is really, really complicated. Understanding what goes on inside the head of a single voter is complicated. There's a ton of political science out there that shows that people don't actually follow the model that we like to sort of think of as being how democracy works, which is that everybody informs themselves about the policy positions of the various candidates and makes a call on who has the best ideas for running the country. What tends to happen instead is that people make their minds up about whether they like the candidates or not, and then in their own minds kind of transmute their policies to fit their own ideas. So, you know, we're going to be talking this evening about, you know, where America goes under Trump. I think the first bit we have to do is try and understand why he won. I've probably read more explanations for this than anyone in the room, or at least I hope I have, because it's my job to do so. And I made a quick count yesterday of, I think I've read 25 sort of theories saying X is the reason why Trump won. Beware of anybody who comes to you and says Trump won because of racism, because of misogyny, because of... There are so many factors that go into this surprising result, and ultimately what you're trying to explain is why a couple of 100,000 voters in the Midwest switched their votes, or rather showed up to vote, and why Hillary Clinton voters stayed at home. So beware people bearing simplifications.
So I'm not supposed to do supplementaries, but I can't resist it. So you sort of reject the notion at the outset that there's been any particular sea change in American outlook?
I think we may be about to get a sea change in American government, American policy. I mean, I think what's true, it was a fairly narrow election result. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. Mm. I think from narrow results like that can come enormous changes. And I think it's quite likely that we get a big change in American government policy in all sorts of areas, though there's a certain amount of uncertainty about that, as you say, because we're still waiting for some big appointments like Secretary of State. So, yeah, I think I'm of the view that there wasn't some sort of gigantic change. The polls all suggested that white working class voters liked Trump a lot. They slightly underplayed that, but not by a huge amount. The thing that surprised me, and I'm still trying to process and understand, is that a majority of white voters with college degrees voted for Trump. That's a puzzle to me. The other thing that's a puzzle from the exit polls is that about 60% of people apparently told the exit polls that they thought Donald Trump wasn't qualified to be president. And yet, you know, clearly a good number of people thought that and voted for him anyway. So, you know, those are two puzzles that I'm kind of...
It's just a few things to be chewing on, then.
Absolutely.
As the evening progresses. Stephen Bush, you're next.
Right, so I thought I would, instead of talking too much about the result, talk about kind of the best case scenario, all the way through to the worst case scenario. I think the interesting thing about the result, though, is that many of the analyses about why it wouldn't happen, weirdly, it turns out, have been validated. It just turns out that there was a big factor which was publicly known, but not enough people were thinking intelligently about, and I include myself in this, which was the Electoral College. There was this argument that America's diversity would inoculate it against a Brexit-style shock, and it did in the popular vote. Trumpism was rejected. But, of course, we should have remembered that the Electoral College was designed to prevent the cities out voting the countryside. That was its original purpose. And, of course, it may now, and I think possibly will, result in the end of American democracy as we know it. That is definitely the sort of, in terms of the possible outcomes of Trump being elected, that, I would say, is the worst-case scenario, but it is very much a plausible scenario. You know, if someone had said to you about George W. Bush or Ronald Reagan, this is the end of American democracy, then I think you should have seen that person as being slightly hysterical. However, that is a realistic, albeit I think slightly unlikely, but realistic outcome of the victory of Trump. So I'm going to start at the kind of upper end, the most positive outcome of Donald Trump's election, drawing on the appointments we've seen so far. It seems fairly clear now from Ivanka attending his meeting with Shinzo Abe, from the way that he is clearly using the mechanics of the Trump organization to woo foreign diplomats, and we are going to see a kind of approach to enriching the first family than we're more used to seeing in post-Soviet or newly post-colonial states.
This is the best case scenario.
This is the best case scenario. But yeah, there's a good phrase by Maya Angelou, which is appropriate in this and all times. When people show you who they are, believe them the first time. So when Trump's first act is to invite the person who is supposedly looking over his business interests in a blind trust to his first meeting with a world leader, don't go, oh, maybe he's kind of settling into the job. You know, he'll settle into it. Take that seriously. You know, take that seriously. When his first appointment is cheered by the American Nazi Party, take that seriously. You know, when people show you who they are, believe them the first time. And so that's kind of what we can see already, a kind of kleptocracy at home, coupled with the significant thing about Jeff Sessions, his choice for Attorney General, will be what he doesn't do. It will be the people he doesn't prosecute for unfair treatment, the police officers he doesn't investigate for behaving in a way which was not in keeping with the spirit of the law. That is probably the best case scenario. Kleptocracy at home, repression of ethnic and social minorities at home, but to be incredibly cruel, we have outside of the United States dealt with American presidents who've had social agendas we haven't liked, and in some cases, this is usually the bit where as a New Statesman journalist I would lose the room, in some cases, in the case of Ronald Reagan, have actually been quite good for global security overall, even while enacting social measures, particularly towards LGBT people, that we would naturally recoil from. And that kind of is a good bridge into the worst case scenario. I've seen a lot of commentary likening Trump to Reagan or Bush or to other Republican presidents. Donald Trump is not a Republican politician of the kind that most people would recognize. In many ways, he is not a Western Democratic politician of the kind that we'd recognize. But if you imagine him in the context of Eastern Europe or post-colonial Africa, suddenly his behavior makes a lot more sense, but it's a lot scarier because, of course, when we've had strong men in Africa and Eastern Europe, they mostly haven't been at the helm of superpowers which can all destroy us. And we've all relied upon, particularly here in Europe, the idea of America as a largely unselfish global actor, as the guarantor for the liberal order. We shouldn't forget that a couple of months ago when Turkey accidentally shot down a Russian plane in the no-fly zone, there is a reason why that didn't spiral into a regional conflict. It was because the White House said discreetly, look, Vladimir, if you start this, you're not going to finish it. Donald Trump has been incredibly supportive of Putin in his public statements, by the look of it in his private statements. We've already seen the first act of the Kremlin after his election was to launch another attack on Aleppo. That is obviously fairly terrifying if you live in the Baltics, but also if you live in Europe generally. The fact that it looks like rather than being a restraining influence, the United States is going to ally itself with Vladimir Putin. And that's where the Secretary of State appointment becomes so critical. If it is Mitt Romney, lots of people in Europe should breathe a sigh of relief for a couple of reasons. One, he believes that Vladimir Putin is a threat to global security and the liberal order, correctly in my view. And secondly, he believes in climate change, which Donald Trump doesn't, which is the other long-term threat to all of our peace and security. And so that is kind of the upper end of the most pessimistic you should be. A president who is friends with Vladimir Putin, who takes his eye off the ball on the last moment to keep our planet habitable and safe, and sees the destruction of the guarantors of the relative stability. And yes, I don't want to belittle any of the conflicts of the last half century, but if you take a longer view about world history, the relative stability of the era of American dominance as the sometimes and fairly sometimes, but the sometimes criticized world policeman, and the potential collapse of that is very much the worst case scenario, because you get all of the bad things I talked about in the first case scenario, which looks certain in terms of the appointments he's made. But this second raft of appointments in terms of his foreign policy positions will tell us whether or not we are dealing with personal catastrophe for many Americans or potentially apocalypse for all of us here.
I think we should all go home. very briefly, Stephen, why, I mean, I appreciate that apocalypse would be the short answer to this question, but why the end of American democracy in its current form?
Well, I think if you want to see a kind of potential vision of the future, look at North Carolina, where the Republicans seized control of the state legislature. They made a deliberate series of events to make it harder for African Americans to vote. They openly boasted about having achieved a fall-off in African American turnout. That was enough for them to win the state, but in the back off, and that's why you should ignore anyone who suggests that this was about trans issues and trans rights, because in North Carolina, a fairly conservative state, that was a centerpiece of the Democrats' campaign, and they took back the governor's house. The Republican governor is now refusing to concede, and it is possible then what will happen is that the state legislature will vote and actually he is still the governor. And we didn't think that Donald Trump would concede before he was in charge of the largest military in the world, right? So if we were worried he wouldn't go, games up, I've lost, in 2016, I see no reason not to be worried he won't go, game up, I've lost, in 2020 either. I'm just a ray of sunshine.
Oh, happy days. Malcolm Chalmers, follow that.
I'm essentially an analyst of UK defence and security policy. So part of what I want to talk about is how the UK should respond to that. But partly to put the context of all this, it's less than a year ago that our government in the UK published a national security strategy looking forward for 5 years. And in April, I had the privilege of sitting with a couple of the authors of that document at a public event in the city discussing a national security strategy. And I said, well, of course, we've got to think of outlandish things that might happen. For example, Brexit and Donald Trump being elected. And the laughter wasn't even nervous because people thought this was such a ridiculous proposition only 6 months ago. And it just shows you how events come and hit you in your face in quite remarkable ways. And I think the election of Trump by such a small margin also reminded me of other events in the distant and not so distant past, where things which it's not really very useful to explain in structural, social, scientific terms. Simply a small change at the margins can make such a difference. After all, if Al Gore had won Florida by a few thousand votes back in 2000, we probably wouldn't have had the invasion of Iraq, and this country would have been very different. So would the United States. If the Labour or Liberal Democrats had got another dozen seats in England last year, we probably wouldn't have had Brexit. So a lot can hang on these small turning points in history. But I think it's also important to realise that turning points in history aren't all about us. They aren't all about the West. After all, the Iraq War and everything that followed, the War on Terror, was in the end triggered by the success of al-Qaeda terrorists in attacking New York and Washington. Without that, the war in Iraq probably wouldn't have happened. And the end of the Cold War wasn't essentially about Ronald Reagan. It was about changes in Russia. And I suspect that's also true looking forward. I think it all remains to be seen where Trump will go. My instinct is that on climate change, he will mark a radical break with the Obama administration. I think that's very clear, and he has a strong support of the Republican Party for that. I think he'll mark something of a break on trade, but I think that was already happening, and Clinton had rejected major trade deals already because of the popular pressure for something to be done on that. But on security, I think there could be more continuity than people believe. On Russia, I think there will be an attempt at a reset with Russia. Trump, I think, will push that despite the views of most of the Republican Party in Congress. But I think there are real limits to how far he'll go, and I would not be at all surprised if 6-9 months down the road from here, Trump attempts to get a deal with Putin and fails, believes that Putin is lying to him, which would not be the first time, and we go back to a more standard Republican Mitt Romney approach to this. A lot will depend on who he appoints as Secretary of State in the next few days. But if it is somebody like Mitt Romney or David Petraeus, I think it will not be such a big change from the past. And then in relation to the Middle East, what Trump said so far is all about having the battle against terrorism, the battle against Islamic State being right at the top of the agenda and everything else being subordinate, including what's happening to the people of Aleppo. Is that a change? It doesn't feel like a radical change from current American policy, which puts the battle against ISIL absolutely at the front and says things about Aleppo and the position of Assad, but actually it does very little about it. So I think fatalism about the fate of Ukraine and Syria is a feature of the Obama administration. I think is likely to be a feature of the next administration, the Trump administration, too, partly because both Obama and Trump have had, and I think will have, a primary focus on domestic issues. They'll be playing to a mood in the American public which is not prepared to take risks with intervention. They're prepared to have cost-free intervention, casualty-free, American casualty-free intervention, but not take the risks and not repeat the experience of Afghanistan and Iraq. And I think that will colour a Trump administration. And I guess the final point I would make is, what does this all mean for us here in the UK? Well, I think one of the lessons for the UK, one of the sets of lessons, were actually drawn out very well in the Chilcot inquiry into the Iraq War. Marvellous report, repays reading, repays absorption as we enter a period like we did when Ronald Reagan came to power, like we did when George W. Bush came to power, where there's a temptation to put so much focus on getting into the inner councils of a new presidency that we sometimes lose sight of our own UK national interest and our own UK national values. And one of the lessons of the Chilcot report is that if you want to protect your own interests and your own values, you have to know what they are and you have to stand up for them robustly from the very early stages of a developing crisis, because over the next 4 years there will be crises, and those will be crises in which our country and the Americans don't agree with each other.
And NATO?
You know, I think there's a lot of nervousness right now in the most exposed parts of NATO, in the Baltic Republics and Poland in particular, because of some of the things Trump said. But Trump has not said, he may have one or two throwaway remarks, but he's not said that he wants to dissolve NATO. What he wants to do is put more pressure on some of the lower spending members of NATO to spend more. And that is absolutely no different from Obama and Biden. I remember before the UK committed to spending 2% of its GDP in defence, the amount of pressure from the American administration and our government to commit to doing so was quite extraordinary. I expect that to continue, but I'm not sure it's so different. A lot will depend on the content of the reset with Putin. And I think it's actually welcome in many ways that we've got another opportunity, Russia's getting another opportunity to climb out the hole into which it's dug itself economically and geostrategically, because it's greatly overextended. But I'm sceptical about whether Putin will take that opportunity. He should be given that opportunity, but I doubt whether he will take it.
Thank you. Malcolm, I should have said earlier, if you want to join the conversation on Twitter, hashtag RSA Trump is the handle that you need, hashtag RSA Trump. And finally, Melanie McDonough.
There's a good side to all this, you know. There's an upbeat aspect to the story, and that is that after this, there is no possibility of ever taking the polling industry seriously ever again. I'm looking forward to a collective exercise in Harakiri on behalf of the industry, and I've been waiting for that since the Brexit vote. It has yet to happen, but I remain confident. I think that the reaction to the election says an awful lot about us and our fears, and rather less about the objective reality of Trump and his commitments and his policies. I think it's a mixed bag myself, and on the whole I think that the upside outweighs the downside, at least so far as it can be discerned. I spoke to two of the Standard's defence contributors before I came, Patrick Coburn and Robert Fox. Robert Fox was saying that the general who's being billed as the likeliest defence secretary, James Mattis, is one of the most intelligent generals on the circuit. He did share with General Petraeus the understanding about the counterinsurgency tactics. He is an exceptionally well-read and erudite man, and our capacity for demonising people before they've had the capacity to disprove themselves, as it were, I think is one of the most troubling aspects of this debate. The other person Robert had time for was General Michael Flynn, who's distinguished as one of the parties who's most likely to be positive in his attitude towards the Russian president. Personally, I think closer engagement with Russia is the bit of the Trump presidency that gives me greatest hope. There is nothing that struck more terror into me personally than Hillary Clinton's declaration during the course of the campaign that she would envisage airstrikes on Russia in the course of the action in Syria. That was carried out, as Malcolm observed, to great effect by Turkey. And it's by a miracle of restraint that it didn't end up far more, in a far more ugly scenario than actually came to pass. I think that the way forward with Russia is unquestionably to acknowledge their legitimate fears as well as their illegitimate aspirations. And I think that close engagement is infinitely more positive and infinitely more productive than the flawed and failed policy of the Obama administration and of Hillary Clinton. One of the things that I rather warmed to Trump about in the course of the debates, incidentally, was that he made clear, whether truthfully or not, I really don't know, that he was against the war in Iraq. Well, certainly Hillary Clinton wasn't against it, and that is something that troubled me at the time. There are some aspects of Trump foreign policy that I warmed to also. Identifying Islamic State as the real threat, the existential threat, as it were, is, I think, absolutely necessary and absolutely moral. Islamic State has committed genocide in the Middle East. It has obliterated, it has wiped out an entire community, the Yazidis. It has raped children from their community. It is holding 3,500 of their young women hostage as sexual slaves. They're being traded and sold over the whole Middle East. This is not a body that we can regard as anything other than an existential threat of a different kind than Russia, of a different kind than any other parties that we're engaging with in that territory. If Donald Trump is making the fight against Islamic State his primary foreign policy objective, and he says it, though we'll see how it goes, then that has my wholehearted backing. There has been a real problem in terms of British and American, and we're talking about Britain in terms of me-tooism in the Middle East, aren't we, in its attitude towards Islamic State in Iraq and in Syria. In Syria, like it or not, the parties most likely to engage with Islamic State are the Kurds, but also the Syrian army backed by Iran and by Russia. If Islamic State is going to be defeated, it is not going to be done by the Kurds with some American airstrikes. It has to be done on the ground, and that will involve the Syrian army. Now, this is something that's quite clear in Iraq. You have the Iraqi army plus Kurds engaging with Islamic State in Mosul. In a parallel endeavour, you have got British and American airstrikes on Raqqa. But the actual business of defeating IS will take place on the ground, and it will involve the Iraqi army. How Britain and America propose to deal with IS by dint of the supposed liberals available in Syria, 70,000 of whom are said to exist, but they're like the Kimra or the Hippogriff. Nobody has actually proved their existence. I do not know. Anyway, there is a fundamental want of clarity between our policy in Iraq and our policy in Syria in regard to IS. If Donald Trump can manage to clarify that confusion, and his two putative appointments, General Flynn and General Mattis, would appear to be able to do that, then I shall be very glad. Now, the other aspect, which has already been alluded to by Malcolm, is that he may require European states to pay more towards NATO. And I think that's a reasonable request. It's a reasonable requirement. And I think that Britain in particular may be spending the 2% of GDP, but it's spending it on the wrong things. The number of ground troops available to Britain, as Malcolm can tell you more cogently than I, is 80,000 heading for 60,000. This is an ineffective force available for a deployment anywhere. If Donald Trump can get the British government to renege on its vanity policy of providing for Trident while it doesn't actually have an effective ground force, then that strikes me as being entirely to be desired. If it actually requires other NATO countries to pay more towards their own defence, that again, I think, will be good for Europe. I don't mind the notion of a European Defence Force. If they want to do it, then that's up to them. But it does seem to be an entirely good and productive outcome of a Trump election. The downside, we've already heard, is that he's got a sceptical approach to climate change, and I can see that that is a genuine problem. Another problem is that he's likely to be uncritically supportive of Israel, possibly on account of the involvement of his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. I'm not by any means suggesting that because he's Jewish he's necessarily supportive of extremists within Israel, but he was the means by which Trump got to meet Benjamin Netanyahu, and I think that that is troubling. Where he's going to be interesting, I think, is in economic terms. The Irish government was having kittens in the last few days on account of the Trump election, not on the basis merely of most of you here, but on the basis that he's proposing to reduce corporation tax dramatically. One reason why companies move to Ireland, why American companies move to Ireland, is that the corporation tax there is about 12.5%. In some cases, where you actually invest in the country, and in R&D, it's even less, it's about half of that. Now, if Trump is proposing to bring American corporation tax down from 39% to something like 15%, and whether he does it or not, I don't know, then I think it's quite legitimate to assume that some American companies which have gone offshore may return to the United States and invest there, which would mean more jobs for Americans, which is a reasonable aspiration on the part of an American president. As I say, it's a mixed bag. There is good sides and bad sides. And frankly, I think it would be better to judge people on what they do in practice rather than attempting to demonise them by dint of association with Trump before they've had the chance to prove themselves.
I think we'll examine your use of the word demonise momentarily, but just John's the only person to mention racism in the context of an election campaign that was riven with it at times. Can you think from history of any examples of someone seeking high office who harnessed racism to achieve high office and then turned out not to be very racist after achieving it?
Well, I can think of any number of people who said things that they didn't really believe in the course.
Specifically to use your word, demonising minorities.
I don't know whether he actually demonised Mexicans as opposed to illegal immigrant Mexicans, and they're not the same thing.
Well, he did. I don't want to get bogged down in this early on, but when he talked about them being racist and murderers, he wasn't talking about the legality of their immigration status, nor when he threatened to ban every Muslim in the world from visiting the country.
Well, he did renege on that, and I'm very glad that he reneged on that. I mean, we all are.
But it's not demonisation, is it, to report things he's said?
No, it's by no means to demonise it, but I'm not suggesting that this is a man with anything but an instinctive capacity for inconsistency, but he did row back on that commitment very, very speedily, and it's now sort of high-level security clearance for people coming from particular Islamic states, which is a very different kettle of fish. So I think that certainly he's said imprudent, silly and non-presidential things in the course of the campaign. Well, in terms of Muslims, it's kind of...
More Mexican.
Or if you're a Mexican, I can see that you're going to take against it. One of the interesting things about this election has been the effect on the...
Just intrigued by your use of the word demonised.
I'll come
back to you on the question of whether or not you can think of any other world leader who sought high office using a racist card and then elected not to be racist afterwards.
It's a bit unfair to
spring it on you. John, you were the only one who used...
I thought of an example, actually. I think Nixon in 68
yes.
pursued... He didn't use racist or racially charged language so much as exploit the backlash against the Civil Rights Act, the famous Southern Strategy, Republican clean sweep in the South. I think in office, he was not sort of actively racist. So I think there could be some examples. Trump and race is a kind of interesting and complicated question. If you look at the polling before, with all the caveats that Melanie's rightly flagged up, there was a very strong association between what American political scientists call racial resentment and Trump voting. So racial resentment is answering strongly positively to questions like, it's really hard to be white in America these days, or if blacks only got off their asses and worked a bit harder, they could do just as well as everyone else. If you answered... 10 out of 10 on that question, that was a very strong predictor of Trump voting. Whether Trump himself said sort of racist things, he clearly generalised about groups of voters. You know, he talked about black Americans, African Americans living in hellholes and so forth. He said, as you said, the stuff early on in the campaign about Mexico sending rapists across the border. There's a sort of fine line there between that and a kind of old-fashioned racism, what I think of as, the kind of classic American racism, which is saying one race is superior to the other. There are alarmingly some people in America, still fairly fringy, but who do actually believe that stuff, who've been energized by Trump's win. Trump hasn't denounced them energetically in the way that he should. There was a meeting in Washington over the weekend of a thing called the National Policy Institute, which essentially believes that America should be a country for kind of white Europeans, that white European Christian, Judeo-Christian culture is under threat from multiculturalism, and that America needs to be a kind of safe space for this culture that's under threat. So there are kind of fellow travelers who believe this stuff, and it's pretty much warmed over white supremacism. I wouldn't say that Trump himself goes in for that, or that he said things that are kind of classically racist in the campaign.
The 60% of white college degree holding women who voted for Trump, you said that still had you puzzled. I appreciate it's a bit unfair to pick you up on the stuff that's got you puzzled.
Yeah, I'm puzzled by that. So when the Trump groping tape came out, at that point, Trump was losing white college-educated women by 25 points in the polls. In the end, he lost white college-educated women just by a sliver and won white college-educated men, which meant that overall he won white college graduates. I was puzzled because I thought it was the kind of thing that cuts through, you know, political obsessives obviously follow all the details of the campaigns, have various points of view about the things that Trump had promised, many of which are completely impossible to deliver, about the kind of flaws in his various plans, about his character and so forth. Even if you weren't paying attention to that stuff, I thought the stuff about sexual assault would kind of break through, and all the polling suggested it would. Now, in the final event, it didn't actually. A lot of people, it seemed, were both appalled by the kind of groping stuff. I'm using the most polite possible language to describe it in case my mum is watching. And in the end, they thought, actually, it's fine. We'd rather have him as president. I think part of what's going on there is for people like me who are sort of political obsessives, we tend to think about politics in some sense as a kind of morality play. We like to see societies making collective calls about what they value and what they don't in an election. You know, we think an awful lot about the kind of character of politicians. It turns out that I think most voters don't think like that. They're fully prepared to put somebody who many Americans thought that Trump was a bad man and yet wanted him in president because, you know, maybe you need a bit of nasty sometimes. And that was something that I didn't see coming.
Do you recognise Stephen's description of a sort of kleptocracy in waiting?
Yeah, so I can totally see where the concern comes from. The norm in American politics since at least the end of the Second World War is that politicians put their assets in blind trusts. Trump is outside the norms in lots of ways. We haven't had such a rich businessman, you know, holding the highest office in the land since, you know, possibly since the kind of 18th century, if you kind of adjust on value terms. So Trump is not going to, even though he said in the campaign he had put it in a blind trust, he's not going to. I think that's bad. I think it will lead to all the kind of conflicts of interest that people worried about with the Clinton Foundation to the power of 10. That said, kleptocracy, I think, you know, for much as Trump likes to talk about himself as this unbelievably successful billionaire, the Trump companies are actually quite small in an American context. This is not like Silvio Berlusconi becoming Prime Minister of Italy, you know, controlling a serious chunk of Italy's economy and kind of systemically important businesses in the media. It's not like kind of Ukrainian oligarchs having a large, you know, kind of chunk of the country's economy and trying to pass laws in order to favour their businesses. I'm not saying I'm not worried. I am worried. I think there's a kind of trampling over norms. I think the next 4 years is going to feel kind of mucky and there will be well-founded accusations of corruption flying around. But I don't see it as a kind of kleptocracy.
Stephen, are you learning anything this evening? Are you softening your position? Are you going to borrow the rose-tinted spectacles, perhaps, of some of your other panellists?
Well, I would say I was at the optimistic end of my topology, because I agree that I think that the NATO thing is a position rather than a start. I am troubled by the... You know, I think Bob Kagan wrote a very good piece in the FT about the relative unselfishness of America as a national actor. I think that we will miss that. I think it's perhaps overly optimistic to believe a couple of things. The first is that people will remember that in Aleppo, the last people to be fighting against the regime were the jihadists. And what the jihadists have always wanted is a frame where they basically say, look, if you're against this regime, it's us or the sea. And what we have clearly demonstrated to the Arab world is actually they are entirely correct. And so I'm not convinced that you can simply say, oh, we need to destroy Islamic State by working with Assad, with Sisi, with everyone. because that's kind of what they want you to say. And I think it's probably worth it's worth taking that aspect on board. You know, it's a bit like kind of, you know, we know, for example, Netanyahu wants there to be a situation where, look, it's me or it's me or Hamas, right? He wants that as well. We've seen that pattern throughout the Middle East. And I think at some point the West does need to stop hoping that if it does the same thing over and over again, that will recur. I think the second point is, I think, in terms of this this demonized point, I mean, Jeff Sessions has been in politics for a long time. He failed to get confirmed by the Senate in the 1980s, a time when Republicans were still regularly filibustering the idea of a national holiday for Martin Luther King. It is not a small thing that he is going to be the most powerful lawyer in the country. And I think if we use words like demonize, I think that is massively minimizing the very real terror of African Americans, the very real terror of women, the very real terror of Hispanics. And I don't think we should throw out words like demonization so casually like that. You know, it's not demonization to point out what someone's entire political career has been based on. And I think in the case of Sessions, he is a deeply troubling appointment.
I'm rather worried that I'm in the position here of being the fallback cheerleader for the entire Trump team. Can I say that I do have problems about Donald Trump. I don't by any means seek to exculpate him for either his sort of off-colour remarks or for his barking mad aspect. And I think we can all agree that there is a barking mad aspect. But I'm simply suggesting that there is a willingness on the part of all of us to run terribly, terribly scared and to believe the worst when we're not taking all of the situation into account. For instance, with Jeff Sessions, I understand that the worst thing that's been said about him was his stupid, wrong joke about the Ku Klux Klan, they're fine so long as they don't smoke marijuana. Now, that was stupid, but it was a bad remark made some decades before. And
I don't think... Dean, he defended the Confederate flag, a flag flown in a war of succession to maintain indentured labour. I mean, yeah, when people tell you who they are, believe them.
If you just pluck one remark from their entire sort of political career spanning decades.
Well, you said one and I've just plucked two. I can pluck a third. I can keep plucking remarks from Jeff Sessions' career. What is the point at which you become concerned about Jeff Sessions? Is it five? Is it six? You know, what is the number of remarks from his career at which point you become concerned for your fellow human being? Now, just give me a ballpark figure.
It's absolutely fine to make Jeff Sessions a special subject. What I'm saying is that...
He's going to be the most powerful lawyer in the country, so I don't think it's, you know, it's not a trivial issue. Is it five?
What I've been seeing in the coverage of the appointments to the Donald Trump entourage is that we've had the same remarks and the same allegations made against them rehearsed again and again without any of this being put into context. For instance, with Mattis, General Mattis, who's been proposed but not confirmed as a nominee, it's his silly, wrong joke about liking to bomb the Taliban that's been rehearsed again and again and again. And in fact, this simply does not reflect the full spectrum of the man's understanding of the situation in the Middle East, and I think his perfectly reasonable approach to it. As regards Aleppo, I'm perfectly willing to take this evening right into the situation in the Middle East and the situation in Syria, and I'll see you afterwards. But I would simply remark that, that the position of the American government in Syria has not been coherent. It's the notion that we've got liberal social democrats in Aleppo and elsewhere waiting in the wings to advance the case against IS is simply not to be borne out. There are 6,000 al-Nusra jihadists who are conducting the fight against Assad. None of us in this room would be safe with them any more than we would be safe with IS. These are not people with whom we can legitimately do business, but they are the people on the ground who are conducting the fight in Aleppo. And it's reasonable to talk about the what's happening there, but it's not reasonable to not to take them into account. Okay. And I think if Donald Trump were to identify Saudi Arabia as one of the most problematic players in the region, then personally I should be absolutely delighted. As I say, I'm not here as an apologist for Donald Trump. I'm not here as an apologist for Donald Trump.
We appreciate that. You'll only be questioned on things you say this evening.
Fine.
OK, that seems reasonable.
That does seem reasonable.
Even in a post-Trump universe. Malcolm, just to pick up on some of these sort of defence and jihadist points, is it simplistic and a little bit crass to suggest that when one of the people under consideration for Secretary of Defense is on the record as describing Islam as a cancer, then ISIS will be rubbing their hands with glee, because this is what they tell their potential recruits that the West thinks about them anyway.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And I think one of the problems of focusing entirely on jihadists, or on ISIS or al-Qaeda before it, or indeed after it, is that there's not going to be a long-term solution or long-term stabilisation in places like Syria in Iraq without having political representation for the Sunni Arab peoples. And it's hard to build an alternative to those jihadist groups, but it has to be part of the process. And one of the reasons it's taking so long in the offensive against Mosul is precisely because it's being organised in a way which increases the possibility of that happening. Now, it may all be for nothing, as was said earlier, it's perhaps a little bit easier in Iraq because there are credible ground forces on the Iraqi and indeed Iraqi Kurd side that can do that, and that's not available to the same extent in Syria. But when we talk about genocide and terrible things from ISIS, we shouldn't forget that a very large number of people indeed have been killed at the hands of the Assad regime. And if we simply say that the solution in Syria is for the Assad regime to reimpose control over most of the country, I don't think that's a recipe for ending the conflict. It doesn't mean that there's an obvious... Often these conflicts, there's not an oven-baked recipe. There's not something simple you can do to solve it. So we have to be more creative. And it's important to remember that, and this is one of the paradoxes actually of the Trump approach, that most of the ground forces supporting the Assad regime in Aleppo and elsewhere, actually Shia militia from Lebanon and Afghanistan and Iraq, paid for by Iran. While Trump is pushing, it seems to be tilting even further towards support for Russia's policy in Syria, he's simultaneously saying he's going to scrap the Iran nuclear deal and move to a much more assertive approach towards Iran. And if he's also now moving to a more assertive position against Saudi Arabia, which I'm not sure he is, but if he were to do so, he wouldn't have many allies left in the region. So that's why my analysis is that faced on a day-to-day, week-by-week basis with the very complexity of the region, I wonder whether he was going to come out of that in a very different position from Obama.
Yes, indeed. But the situation that we have at the moment, which Hillary Clinton would have inherited and perpetuated, is utterly incoherent in that the only force capable of dealing with Islamic State is a force for which she would not have engaged. You're absolutely right to identify Iran as the weak point, the least consistent point in the whole sort of Trump philosophy, because I think that, again, closer engagement is a more productive endeavour.
Hang on, I might steer things back to domestic American politics before we throw open for questions. Before I do that, though, when President-elect Trump said that he had a plan for dealing with ISIS, I believe it is the best plan. It's an amazing plan. You won't believe what a great plan it is. Would you just raise a hand if you think he has got any plan at all?
He said he'd bomb the shit out of it.
I stand corrected.
That does seem to be pretty well what we're trying to do in Raqqa. So if it is a Shiite policy, it's one that's actually shared by the present American administration and the British government. I don't think that you can sort of put him in the naughty corner for that alone.
The current policy should be in the naughty corner. I think the thing is that there seems to be this...
No, I'm not having it. I'm steering it back to America. Sorry. If I did write memos to self, which I don't, I would probably have said something like, don't ask the bloke from The Economist a really simple question about markets. But I don't write memos to self. So, John Prideaux, why have the markets responded so positively to the, some would say, cataclysmic election of Donald Trump?
Because markets are not as wise as, free marketeers like to think they are. I think they're making a kind of short-term bet that Donald Trump will do the things that they like economically and won't do the things they don't like. So that he will effectively juice the economy by borrowing lots of money, spending lots of money on infrastructure. You'll get a boost from that, and he won't do the stuff that would push the economy in the other direction, which is taking his immigration policy seriously or tearing up trade agreements with NAFTA or starting a trade war with China. The markets know more about what Trump will do than, you know, than anyone else. So let's wait and see. But they've taken a very, you know, kind of, they've taken all the good bits and discounted all the bad bits.
And briefly, if you would, what do you think it means for Brexit to have Trump in the White House come January?
Good question. I think, I think that people who say that it means it's brilliant for Britain because it means that some free trade deal with the US will be forthcoming immediately probably have reckoned without the fact that Trump campaigned on an explicitly kind of anti-trade platform, that America will have an awful lot of other things that it wants to get done, you know, before doing some trade deal with the UK. The trade deals take a really long time to put together, and actually, you know, when pressed, UK consumers might not be crazy about American cars and American beef, you know, ending up on the for sale. So what's it mean for Brexit? I mean, it seems to me that it's part of a piece with Brexit in the kind of, as we began, a kind of pulling apart of the kind of post-war order. You know, if Marine Le Pen wins in France next year, the, you know, pulls France out of the European Union, that, that process will be complete.
Melanie, Brexit and Trump, any kind of impact?
But I'm trying to get my head around the notion that TTIP, which is something that people on the left, I think quite legitimately, have been protesting about and marching about and demonstrating about in places from London to Berlin, that's going to be scrapped as a result of the election of Trump. So TTIP, which we, I think, had agreed among right-minded people was actually the worst possible sort of deal that we could have got. It's now going to be scrapped.
But I'm wrong-minded.
Yes, the Economist, by definition, is going to take the other view. But a lot of his economic policy could have been scripted by Jeremy Corbyn. It's to take advantage. The Breitbart guy, Steve Bannon, he was sort of saying we're going to take £1 trillion and sort of throw it at the wall and see what sticks. So, effectively, the Corbynite approach to take advantage of low interest rates and fling it at American infrastructure may indeed produce the desired results, which is more jobs and some sort of economic stimulus. Naturally, like everybody else, I think I'm terrified at the notion of impediments to free trade. But so far as the economic stimulus goes, I think it's a formula that could possibly work.
Malcolm, can you? I know it's not necessarily your kind of obvious field. But
well, I think there are really important security and foreign policy aspects of this question. I think the risk is that leaving the European Union at precisely a time when relations with America are more risky exposes us to a double risk. It doesn't necessarily mean it's all going to go pear-shaped, but there is a real risk that we're going to be left out in the cold in trade terms, but also in terms of reliable partners on a wide range of security issues. And because we're going to have this enormous negotiation of so many different things in the security area with the Europeans, at the same time as our role, our traditional role of being a broker between the two sides of the Atlantic, is thrown into question. So I think we could feel really pretty alone, and I hope that's not what happens, but that's my fear.
And that could be the sort of watchword for much of, not just this evening, but all of these sort of discussions. I hope that's not what happens, but I have to acknowledge the possibility that it might be. Stephen, on the Brexit question?
I think Brexit actually did present a bit of an opportunity. Sorry, Trump presented a bit of an opportunity for Britain's Brexit deal in that it has many members of the EU's periphery more worried about their security. And that is obviously something that Britain can give the EU. However, the mistake that was then made by Downing Street was to immediately start talking about this, oh no, you can't have an EU army. I mean, we're leaving, so actually there comes a point when it would behoove us to shut up about whether or not they want a European army. And secondly, to talk about, oh, this era of Thatcher and Reagan, ignoring the many differences between Reagan and Trump. And so I think that may mean that the goodwill it was possible to win by acting perhaps as the guarantor for some bits of the EU periphery have vanished. The second, in terms of the fraught question, because obviously we are definitely leaving the EU, there's a question of what sort of flavour of Brexit you go for. My instinct is actually you can really only have a hard Brexit in terms of the single market, and all of the other options are a bit of a mirage. But in terms of leaving the customs union, I actually think TTIP, there were problems with it, but trade deals are really hard to negotiate, particularly when you have that many actors involved.
I think it shows the utter foolishness of leaving the customs union. This idea that there is a then this is a world that wants to strike trade deals. I mean, every trade deal around the world is facing opposition from the left, the right, bits of the centre, etc., etc. So it shows this idea that some people in Whitehall have that you can unlock a vista of trade deals is for the birds. And so it's both an opportunity to get a better exit deal, but it also shows that we should perhaps be slightly less relaxed about burning all of the deals we got in an era where people were perhaps more receptive to free trade.
Do you know, and forgive my ignorance on this, do we retain our power of veto after Article 50 is triggered?
Yes.
Until we're in the
exit queue. So they can still put the kibosh on any European army until the negotiation is complete. I believe that's called crowdsourcing information, I think. Speaking of crowdsourcing, raise your hand if you have a question for the panel. Feel free to direct it at... Feel free to direct it at any individual, or if you don't want to, leave it to me to decide on your behalf. I'll start with the gentleman furthest away with the newspaper in his hand there.
Thank you, Chair. I wonder if the panel could comment on when the present episode of disillusionment with governments, politicians and their elites began. Was it as far back as, say, in this country, for example, the miners' strike in 84? Thank you.
Briefly, I'll start with you, Malcolm, actually, if I may. This kind of incremental disillusionment reaching critical mass, you could say, in 2016, where would you date its origins?
I think it's been greatly accelerated by the 2008 financial crisis, but I think it's been there for two or three decades, and I think it speaks to the fact that in the quarter century after World War II, the fruits of growth were widely shared, but I think since then, since the 1980s or so, it's been increasingly less widely shared, and that's been accelerated over the last decade.
Stephen?
I think I would just broadly agree with that. I don't think I have anything to add.
Fair enough. Melanie?
I think probably in Britain, the Iraq War, I think that there was a substantial body of trust in politicians prior to Britain being taken to war in Iraq on, it turned out, a false basis. And I think after that, I don't think the credibility of the political class could stand up to what happened. And we must remember that Blair wasn't alone. He had the support of the opposition. Well, everybody except the Liberal Democrats.
I know it feels like I'm picking on you, but he also had the support of Donald Trump. He's on the record as saying...
Well, that's what he disputes. That's one of the nice things about him, that he tries to renege on support for the Iraq War, if he had it at the time.
Certainly Clinton
did have it.
Yes.
I'd go a tiny bit further back. I agree with the stuff about the financial crisis and the Iraq War, clearly bad for those experts in government and so forth. In an American context, if you look at the polling, it changes in 1965, huge increase in scepticism about government. People go from believing the government's, you know, broadly acts in their interest to a lot of people thinking it doesn't. That's the year after passage of the Civil Rights Act, unfortunately. So there's some racialized stuff about attitudes to government in the US. I would also add, I think the end of the Cold War, in a strange way, has been bad for the West in terms of sort of robbing it of an enemy that had diametrically opposed values. And I think part of what we're seeing is a kind of the absence of that.
Thank you very much for the discussion. We have two very important elections coming up in the spring and next fall in France and Germany. Mm. Any insights you think from the Trump election, or any implications of the Trump election on those outcomes?
Okay, hang on, I've got that one. Gentleman here, simply by dint of being in my eye line all night.
Yeah, this is really a question for Stefan. Considering the upswing of racially motivated crime after Brexit, and considering the racially motivated statements and the things that people have said in the States with Trump, my question is really, what would prevent another civil war in America, a very different kind of civil war, with the blacks and Hispanics?
Nice, ease yourself into questions. nice gimmies. And the gentleman here with the second best beard in the room.
Surely there's an equally interesting story, not just about the winners, but about the losers. And Hillary Clinton's huge amount of money and huge political machine was shown to be irrelevant.
To the question, sir.
And much of the GOP was shown to be irrelevant. What is the story about the losers?
Okay, so how big a role did the loser play in the victory of the victor? So we'll start with France and Germany. We'll start with you very briefly.
I know a bit more about France than I know about Germany, so that's a disclaimer. And I think to some extent the fact that both Trump and Brexit have happened will inoculate people a bit about complacency when it comes to Marine Le Pen. I think French people will take it very, take the likelihood of her winning very seriously. I do think that in France there remains a bit of a distinction between what people in France call the clean right and the dirty right. And, Marine Le Pen clearly descends from the dirty right. That said, she's a pretty slick saleswoman for what she's selling. So I think I would hope some inoculation against overconfidence.
Malcolm, on the French and German questions, do you think
that I would worry even more about Italy. I think Renzi is going to lose the referendum and he may well fall, and all the opposition parties are anti-EU, so I worry more about them. I think in the end Le Pen will be defeated and Merkel will remain Chancellor. She may have to form a different sort of coalition, but I think Italy is my main worry.
Melanie?
In terms of France and Germany, I think we should note, Stephen, that François Fillon, the antagonist, the likely antagonist to Marine Le Pen, is very much in favour of the Trump approach of holding Russia close and taking account of its legitimate security concerns. So if you are thinking that this is a better option, then you may have problems.
I think it's definitely the better option than the person who doesn't think I should be able to hold my partner's hand in public, which is what he's facing in France.
But in Germany, I think Angela Merkel will win. I'm not sure that she deserves to. I think her asylum policy was wildly irresponsible. But to admit a million people in the course of a year is something that no sensible politician should have done. And by comparison, and it's not often I say this, British approach to asylum was more rational. As regards the losers, I think we have got to consider the people who voted for Donald Trump, other than the unexpected group which the pollsters didn't identify, and I'm happy to see that you didn't either. And that is the disgruntled and disenfranchised and alienated blue-collar workers.
The most covered subject in the run-up to the election was how pissed off white working-class Americans were.
Yeah, and we didn't take account of the college-educated.
No, it was that. It was, but it I was think the, as it was the upscale. If you look at the exit polls by income, Trump won the wealthiest Americans, and the people towards the top. Actually, Clinton won those right at the bottom, partly because of the way poverty skews with race in America. So there's a kind of...
Yes.
The kind of rage of working class white America I was sort of expecting. The bit I wasn't expecting was
the college educated
aspect. Folks like us, frankly.
Yes.
Speak for yourself. Yeah.
The people who one worries about are the putative Trump supporters, and in fact, some of the actual Trump supporters.
Back to the question, do you think Bernie Sanders would have won, or a more palatable Democrat, perhaps, or not?
I'm just wondering, where does the Republican establishment have any relevance anymore? What does the Democrats have to say to the electorate since they've been so resoundingly steamrolled?
I don't know if anyone.
This guy who's a slug.
I don't know if anyone can answer that question.
But it may be this is an opportunity for the Republican Party to remake itself with a more viable coalition, because increasingly over the last couple of decades, the Republican elite has got out of touch with its electorate, and that's one of the reasons why the Democrats are doing better. Now Trump could be their saviour if they could only see it.
Stephen, no one ever thinks real horror is around the corner, or at least if they do, they generally get shouted down. The question posits the possibility of real horror being around a corner. Do you buy it?
I think the thing about being from a minority, and obviously as you'll visibly be able to tell, I'm black, but I'm also Jewish on my grandfather's side, is that there isn't always a happy ending to every historical story, which I think, in the nicest possible way, white Gentiles often forget. When we talk about, we got through Hitler, well, we who? Lots of people did not make it to the end of that story. I think your question about the losers speaks very well to your question. One of the problems for Hillary Clinton, because she was a weaker candidate, is she had to, partly to see off Bernie Sanders, partly because she didn't really have a movement of her own, she had to wrap herself in movements like Black Lives Matter, Mothers of the Movement,
And we've always seen in the American context that whenever there is a gain for the ethnic minority poor, because there is this raced context that doesn't really exist in here in Europe in the same way, there tends to be a white political reaction. And I think Hillary, through being so explicit in her support of those campaigns, didn't help herself. But of course, she couldn't have seen off Bernie without her firewall among African Americans, and she couldn't have done that without speaking to those issues. So she was kind of in a damned if she did, damned if she didn't. Although the other point with Hillary is she lost in the 2008 primaries despite winning the popular vote. She lost in 2016 despite winning the popular vote. And in both cases, the margins were quite fine, and they were avoidable campaign errors. So I think there's an element to which actually some of the lesson for the Democrats is just don't make stupid mistakes.
Don't nominate someone everybody hates.
Yeah, and yeah, kind of it's
20 hindsight.
It's very easy to see. Yeah, in terms of the Le Pen question, I think again there's a very different political context. In terms of the pollsters who actually didn't get the US election that wrong, because it now appears that Hillary actually will get that, it just her vote was really inefficiently distributed. They've got quite good at polling how the far right will do. People have had many opportunities to vote for Le Pen before. My instinct is the Republican front will assert itself. With Angela Merkel, the question is not whether or not she'll come first, but whether or not the numbers for this coalition of the losers, of red-red-green, are there. And I don't know enough about what they'd need to do to get the extra 10% it is they'd need on current polling. But my instinct is actually Le Pen will be seen off. Whether it's Juppé or Fillon doesn't really matter. I think, to be honest, if you think, obviously I have disagreements with Fillon's foreign policy, but if you think that any minority is looking at the French election thinking, oh, shucks, I hope it's not a pro-Putin candidate, the extent to which you have not got your arms around what is at stake in the French election is frankly a bit of an embarrassment, TBH. But that's probably enough about the French elections.
TBH. TBH, Stephen, not GBH. That will... that does indeed conclude proceedings for this evening. I'm so sorry. I, what can I say? We'll do it again next week, shall we? You may need to run that by the management. Please join me in thanking our panel, John Prideau, Melly Madonna, Stephen Bush and Malcolm Chalmers. I'm James O'Brien. Thank you and good night.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.